Hi, I'm Gigi, and this is Driven Minds, a Type 7 podcast. In this series, we talk to today's most renowned thinkers and doers to learn how they navigate through challenging periods of their lives. By sharing our stories, we hear ourselves and others, our thoughts, our worries, our insecurities, and only then do we realize that we are never as alone as we think we are. So, my friends, I don't think I ever mentioned that this podcast has seasons, but it does. And alas, the first season is done. 12 episodes, making this episode lucky number 13. Thankfully, I'm an optimist, which you probably didn't know. Otherwise, I would have to make an episode 14. You probably do know by now that I am a professional overthinker. So what better way to flex that muscle than to have a season review with a special guest named Ted Gushue. He's the editor-in-chief of Type 7, and this podcast is part of the Type 7 family, but I'm going to let Ted explain what that means in way better words than I can. So what's going to happen is that Ted and I are going to take a step back and rehash some of our favorite moments throughout the last 12 episodes and use them as a type of bouncing off point to do what we do best on this show, which is open up about our mental struggles and have conversations. So Ted and I have actually never met IRL because this podcast was launched during COVID, and COVID had its own very lonely rule book. But we have gotten to know each other virtually, and we also found out that our main point of connection is that we both spent the beginning of our adult years in New York City. It is a place that makes your nightmares and dreams come true, sometimes all in a single night, especially in your 20s. But we're going to get into all of that. When I spoke to Ted, he was in the middle of a vineyard in rural France. Rural is so hard to say. Rural. Either way, it made me jealous AF, but you cannot have it all. So here it is, our season review and conversation with Ted Gushue.
Beginning of last year, I really never thought about wine and anything other than what you and I probably were growing up with drinking culture, which is drink as much as possible, as fast as possible.
So, red cups all the way.
No, I mean, this was the culture like we grew up with, which is in the U.S. drinking is illegal up until 21. So let's drink the cheapest possible stuff that we can steal as little kids and try to drink it in a really unhealthy way. So when I started living in Switzerland, I have a friend who's a really great wine dealer and a wine expert, and he put me down this path of actually, having a really thoughtful relationship with wine, mm-hmm. as opposed to a consumption-based relationship. Mm. So I became somebody who was much more interested in the storytelling aspect and the history of these places that are, really so famous, and that's just been like my latest journey with alcohol as a substance in my life, which has been a positive one at times and a super negative one at times. Mm-hmm, I've gone through periods where I wasn't drinking at all, and I was actually going to Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to learn about my relationship with the drug. And now I'm like, okay, how can I go and meet the actual winemaker and learn about the history? So that's what you've caught me doing this week, and it's a pleasure to catch up with you finally.
So I want to dig in, just for anyone who isn't familiar, can you tell us what Type 7 is and your day-to-day?
So Type 7 was a project that was started with the Porsche global marketing team and myself when I left Petrolicious in 2017. They approached me to start talking about how can we make sure that... Let me phrase it this way. Porsche is a company that makes, in my opinion, art. The cars that they make are sculpture, they're engineering. They are 10,000 disciplines of art that come together to make one product that is a rolling sculpture. And so if Porsche wants to exist in 100 years, and the average person who went to a school like you did, in a city like you did, thinks to themselves, cars are lame. Mm. You can't cure that by buying billboards, and you can't cure that by throwing advertising money, kind of randomly. So what we decided to create was a really genuine from the soul editorial product that helped tell the story of Portia as part of a larger conversation of art and culture, because it is, and it always has been, and Portia has always shaped these things. So we are a magazine that has one sponsor, and that sponsor is Portia, and we talk about everything that is relevant to that message, which, you know, we have some of the greatest architects in the world that we feature their work. We have some of the best photographers. Like, we try to showcase the best of everything. And then what happens is, alongside of that, we also tell the story of young people that are actually passionate about Portia around the world.
And yeah, the Type 7 community is growing and vibrant. So you've really nailed it there.
But you get to talk to the coolest people.
I know. And speaking of those people, I want to get into this because you are the season finale. And what we're going to do is take a cruise, so to speak, down memory lane and rehash some of the themes that came up throughout the first season. And we're going to get down and dirty with all of the good topics like anxiety, relationships, self-doubt, heartbreak, body image. And then Ted and I are going to talk about how these themes resonated with us, with my personal goal of coaxing you into divulging your deepest, darkest secrets. I did warn you about this, Ted. So, you know, I hope all is kosher.
Totally.
I want to kick this off by going back to the first episode, which was Brian Grazer. And a big part of Brian's story was about social anxiety, which one might not necessarily expect because he's been in the forefront of the Hollywood limelight for decades. And he deals with all types of people all day, every day, on set, off set, in the office, as this Hollywood mega producer. And I'm curious what your experience has been with anxiety.
Well, he really resonated with me because he was, if I remember correctly, he's also dyslexic.
Yes, that was a huge thing.
So I have a mild form of dyslexia, and it's something it's something that I've just functioned with and gotten on with in a very kind of New England upbringing sort of style. But everything that he said about his social anxiety, about his about having something like dyslexia, where you're just like, why am I like just a bit slower than everybody else? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These were all things that resonated with me because they're all things that I've either privately dealt with or professionally had diagnosed or anything like this. You know, I have extreme ADHD that was diagnosed. I was medicated for years when I lived in New York, much like almost everyone else I knew in New York.
It's really an epidemic.
I was on Vyvanse for like 5 years and it was a disaster. Like I was completely unhappy on that drug, and it was doing stuff to my body and to my mental state that I was really unhappy with. But then it became, you know, in 2010, when I got to New York, these weren't conversations that people were having. It was just like, why aren't you on Adderall? Why aren't you medicated? Why aren't you partying till 6 in the morning? What's wrong with you? And that was, you know, 2010, like right after the crash, when everything was coming back in New York City, that was just the vibe. It was just everyone was going full gas 100% of the time, and you needed to be medicated just in order to like to compete. And I think that's a huge issue in New York, especially of that just medication lifestyle to sidestep the actual hard part of doing the work that gets you to a good place.
Did you have an experience with anxiety, or was it just ADHD?
No, I always had some form of anxiety because I'm an extremely empathic person. Like I feel everyone's feelings all the time, and it's really one of those things where I'm not. How do I describe it? I'm not somebody who's capable of going into a room and not immediately feeling the entire vibe of the room to the point where it can be crippling. So like really like if you start telling me a story about your dog dying or something and you start crying, I'm crying. Like there's no choice. It's not I can't shut myself off to that. So as a result, you know, you get to a point where you're so empathic that you start misreading people's feelings of what you think they're thinking about you. So you get into a point where you start thinking that people are saying negative things about you But in reality, then maybe they're not saying anything. So like being empathic does not mean you're always right, if that makes sense. Like you can start sucking in feelings that actually aren't even there. And when I was heavily prescribed all these drugs, and when I was living in New York, this was something that would be magnified hugely, because you have this like amphetamine rush that kind of fuels that fuels that anxiety and makes you like hyper focus on, maybe they're saying something about me. Oh my God, I can't believe they're saying, oh my, what have I done? Did I say something wrong? Did I offend somebody? And so once I got away from that, you know, you take a lot of the fuel away from the anxiety, because you're not giving it an artificial source of energy, but you end up getting to a place where you can say, look, I know what's real and I know what's not real. And even though something might feel real, I have the mental experience and knowledge at this point to say to myself, to disarm it, if that makes sense.
How do you do that though?
It's through being radically intellectual about it. You know, I'm somebody who has no problem being extremely honest with himself. So I'll be like, you feel like you've got a whacked out body image today. Why? What's going on? Well, you haven't gone for a run in 3 weeks. You've been drinking a lot of Bordeaux and you've been eating nothing but cheese. Like, oh, okay. So it's probably the fact that I've been like kind of neglecting my body for the past few weeks, which has given me this anxiety around my body image issues. And then it's like, oh, okay. Well, then that's what it is. So then I know what to do. It's the thing in my experience comes around when you actually can't make the jump to being honest about what your actual issues are. And it's something that you talk very openly about. And you're like, no, it's actually, if I talk about it, then I can look at it. It's like why I started going to therapy.
Exactly.
Why I started going to therapy. You can take the hat off and look at the hat, as opposed to being in a room with no mirrors. So it's like, it makes perfect sense. You go, oh, there's the problem. Then if you choose then not to do something about it, then it's your fault. You're the asshole.
In reference to what you said about body image, I know this sounds nuts, but I also said this to Justin during our episode, because until he came on the show, I'd never had a real conversation with a man about body image.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I didn't know the issue was on the radar to that extent. I always assumed it was a woman's issue, because that is what has been perpetuated so heavily. Do you feel the pressure to work towards a certain body or look a certain way?
Yeah, I mean, I was bulimic for almost a decade. Like, because
really?
Because I got into my mind such an image of how I was supposed to be. And my relationship with food and impulse control around food was so out of whack that I was manifesting like this internal dialogue that I'd gotten from an ex-girlfriend in university. And I just was like, I would be casually bulimic for a decade. And it was something that I eventually kind of woke up from, because I was in such I didn't feel controlled by it, but I would just notice, I'm like, oh, you know, you just watched yourself eat like a ton of cake. Or whatever it was, like, you know, eat a whole slice of pie and then like go bring it up like this. And I've talked about it with my therapist, and I've talked about it with friends, and I'm happy to talk about it here, because I think it's, men are just as at the mercy of this as women. And it's not something I'm ashamed of. I'm like, okay, that's part of my life. That's how that happened. It's not affecting me at the moment, but you know, you can get to a place pretty quickly that gets you into a relationship where you're not happy with food and you're not happy with your body. And in reality, like, I'm, you know, doing better physically than I have in a while, but I still, like, I'm like, my nipples are kind of puffy. You know, it still gets into your head, these little things you had. Because in gym class in high school or in middle school, I was, you know, the kid with puffy nipples and I had boobs. And it was like, you know, I was teased mercilessly as a kid because I was overweight always, because I come from a very indulgent family and we always enjoyed everything, the best of food and everything. Really, we lived our life very, very, in hindsight, you know, we had a great time. But I look at my life with such pleasure and pride, and I've had such an amazing ride. So keep that as an asterisk with everything I'm telling you. Like, looking back, I wouldn't change anything. Like, I'm somebody who's deeply grateful for every opportunity that I've gotten to experience, because I've gotten to do some taste, try, fly, go, drive, to do some of the most amazing things anyone's ever done in life. But I would be lying if I said that I wasn't teased mercilessly as a kid and was fat shamed and, mm-hmm. and all these things that gave me all sorts of like just issues that I had to overcome that were kind of superficial that I didn't need, you know, like,
right.
a big part of my life philosophy is I never take myself so seriously. So, you know, yes, I was teased mercilessly. Yes, I was done all these things, but I don't want to feel like I was a victim. Like it just happened and that's the way it was. And I'm still just delighted to be alive and I'm having a great time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think long and hard about those moments that were painful as a kid. You know, I almost died of whooping cough. I almost died of pneumonia several times.
Wow.
I remember like I was allergic to grass, but like I was obsessed with learning how to play soccer. So like I sucked at soccer. I was the worst person playing soccer because I was just wheezing the whole time. And this was the 90s. So nobody was like, oh, perhaps my son has like an allergy to a special pollen. They were just like, well, he just sucks at soccer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So I'm like, I can look back on it and laugh and be like, well, yeah, you know, obviously I was had a physical disability that made it so I suck at soccer. But at the time, my dad was like, what are you, the cameraman? You're always just filming outside the action, you know? So I have a good sense of humor about it. And that to me is the ultimate, the ultimate key in my life is just learning how to laugh about all of this and move on from it, because I'm really blessed to live the life that I do, and I'm really grateful for it.
You mentioned that you were in a relationship when the bulimia started. What was it about the dynamic that set it off for you?
Well, it was more the relationship was around. Like I was 70 pounds heavier than I am now when I started that relationship.
Okay.
And I lost 60 pounds in like 3.5 months, like through caloric restriction and diet restriction. And my weight has yo-yoed a bunch of times. As a kid, I became obsessed with the Atkins diet. Like I was like 14 years old doing the Atkins diet because I was just I was a really big kid, and it was uncomfortable and wasn't fun. So I always had a way to do something about it. And then once I got to my goal weight, it wasn't like she encouraged me to start becoming bulimic. I just looked at it as a mental excuse to like, to be able to cheat on my diet. It wasn't even, I didn't even have like a shame about it. I was just like, oh, let me do this. And it was something that would happen maybe once a month. It wasn't it didn't dictate my life, but it was something that I was like, you know what? This kind of sucks that I'm even like thinking to get down this pathway, that instead of me learning how to enjoy the right amount of pizza, I'm going to enjoy so much pizza that I feel terrible. And that was like, I can't describe the moment that became uncool to me in my head of like, okay, eating the right amount of pizza is actually cool. And I've reached a point now where I understand better what my body needs to be happy. You know, I'm 32. Like, this isn't a new meat suit. You know, I'm getting there. And then I listen to a lot of other people talk about their struggles. I listen to your podcast. I listened to a number of other really educated people talk about their struggle. And then I see a therapist, which allows me just like this conversation to talk about, you know, things that aren't going as they should, and learning about why that's not happening and learning about that. And, you know, I even during lockdown, it was really difficult to get a good therapist while I was living in Switzerland. So I went through BetterHelp, which was, you know, shout out BetterHelp.
Yep.
They're not even a sponsor,
yeah,
but like
it's a great platform.
They sponsor a lot of podcasts, but like I got paired with an amazing therapist who's in Wisconsin. It was Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, and we had a 6-month relationship over video chat, you know, a couple times a week checking in, and it was super helpful. You know, even still. Much like everyone else, I was going insane by the end of the last lockdown, but it really, I think it minimized the potential damage of a global pandemic on my psyche.
The most empowering theme that ran throughout the season, at least for me, was how people seemed to use their struggle as creative fuel. For instance, Sarah Baba used her art as a vessel to deal with her food issues, remember?
Yeah.
And Licky Lee channeled her pain from heartbreak into her songs. Did you have any struggles that ended up fueling your work?
I mean, anyone who's creative is struggling. This is my experience in my life. And I have a lot of beautiful creative friends who do a beautiful job expressing themselves in a very positive way. But that, in my experience, creativity, it comes out of an internal struggle. And I don't care who you are, like if you think that you're not, you're probably lying about it to yourself, if that makes sense. I think everyone is struggling. I think everyone has casual issues. I think everyone worries about the shape of their body. I think everyone has these issues based on the way our society's been structured for so long. You know, some of us have a better mm-hmm. vocabulary at this point because we've stopped and said, no, feeling like this sucks. Hang on. Why do I have to feel like this? And eventually you get to a point where you go, I don't want to feel like this anymore. And let me go work on it. So to say, you know, have I had struggles? Yeah, absolutely. I was financial struggles. By the time I was starting at Type 7, I was negative $80,000 in credit card debt because it took me 16 months to get from this beginning of the idea over the line with the idea. So personally, I was in the worst financial position of my life. I was really trying to keep a lifestyle afloat that would allow me to go and work on a project that I was destined to work on and dreaming of working on. But I took a risk and that was a struggle. And then it pays off and then I moved on. But, there's been many points in my life where I've had struggle that has fueled me to keep going. And it's always been to me something along the lines of like, I just didn't want to move home. You know, I mentioned this to you on our prep call the other day. And I said, look, I'm not a complicated mm-hmm. person. I'm somebody who wants to see the world, who wants to do great work, be remembered for my work being thoughtful and special. And at the end of the day, I just, once I said to myself, you can't move home, it became very clear everything else I had to do, which was just anything. You know, when I got to New York, I had a degree in finance that was worthless because I was going to become, it was the global financial crisis meltdown, part one. I don't know which part we're on now, but it feels like you know, the 70th. But like 2009, 2010, my degree with my parents had paid, had overextended themselves financially to pay for, God bless them for doing so, was completely worthless because not a single person in the world was hiring in that field. So I said to myself, you're not moving home. And I moved directly to the city. I crashed on a friend's couch. And within a week, I had a gig as a DJ on Wednesday nights at a club called The Eldridge, which at the time was like a super hot nightclub. And then it turned into a residency at a hotel. And then that hotel later on, after I became a party journalist, hired me to start a magazine for them. So I've had this crazy career that's come out of me saying to myself, I refuse to go back. And that perseverance is what I push for.
When you started as a DJ, did you experience any sort of imposter syndrome, or were you able to just own the opportunity and dive right in as essentially the conductor of the party, right? Because I also started as a DJ, as you know, and I went through imposter syndrome all of the time, like getting booked for these gigs. As like sometimes like my third or fourth gig, I was booked for the opening of the Tribeca Film Festival, and I was playing on stage with the band The National. There was a moment where I was like, wait, like, what are these buttons? You know, because I'd never done a proper gigantic gig before. So I'm curious if you experienced any of that, because I remember The Eldridge. It was a hot place.
I still experience imposter syndrome. And I think that people who claim they don't are lying. I think if
mm-hmm,
you...
I agree.
There's this great quote by Mario Andretti, who's a famous racing driver, and he goes, "If you're not if you're not going fast enough to feel like you're about to crash, you're not racing." And I think there's something to be said that if you extract what he's really trying to say there, and apply it to life in general, you know, if you're so comfortable and so cozy in what you're doing, you're not pushing. You're not pushing to the next level. You're not getting to a place of new heights. You're not taking your career to a new place in any medium, whether it's DJing, whether it's finance, whether it's, you know, if you're not really out there, you know, overextending yourself to the point of feeling like, man, I don't even belong in this room. Then you're in the wrong room. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always believed that. And,
yeah.
And so I always have imposter syndrome with almost everything I do. I had it before we got on this call. I'm like, I don't deserve to be in a podcast next to Tyra Banks and Ariana Huffington and all these people. Like, you know, but then I go, you know what? If I wasn't in that room, and if I wasn't in this podcast, I wouldn't be doing the thing I need to be doing anyways. So that's always been my little like kind of mental trick is like, if you don't feel the imposter syndrome, you are the imposter. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's oversimplifying it, but it's really my philosophy. It's just like, if you're comfortable, you're not pushing.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you.
I really heard it though in your first interview with Brian Grazer. You were like, I don't even know how to say words anymore. Here we go. This is
What's funny is that I've started working at Vogue in 2013. And then after that I went to W. I've interviewed countless celebrities over a course of 7 years. I've been doing this professionally, and then all of a sudden when there's a microphone in my face, I'm like, wait, I don't know how to interview. And I called my mom freaking out, and she was like, you've interviewed Spike Lee, Natalie Portman. You've like, what are you talking about? Of course you know how to do this.
Yes, there's that moment where you forget everything, but then you go, you just all of a sudden like something kicks in. And you saw it in the podcast. In the beginning of the interview, you're just like, you're a little, I don't know, how do I describe it? You were a small deer in the headlights. And then by the end.
Completely. My voice is shaking, Ted.
But then by the end of it, you've taken it by the horns and you're owning it. So if you hadn't done that, if you had allowed yourself to become victim to the imposter syndrome as opposed to using it, you would still be in that waiting room and you wouldn't have had the interview and talked to this amazing guy who's done the most amazing things. So I don't know. I think we need imposter syndrome because it reminds us that we're in a place that, you know, five levels ago, we had no business ever imagining that we'd be there. So I don't know. I use it as fuel for me, frankly.
I want to go back to heartbreak because you briefly touched on it. And I don't know if you noticed, but there was so much heartbreak in this season. And I mean, I guess that's also just by virtue of being human. We all have hearts that can and do break. And this is a safe space, so no pressure, but also pressure. Was there a heartbreak that particularly changed you?
I think every girlfriend I've had, I thought I was going to marry.
Really?
Every like serious relationship. Like I've dated a lot of very great women, but I've had like three or four, let's call it three, really, really significant relationships where I thought, okay, this is it. This is what I want. And each time I was proven totally wrong, which creates, you know, I think heartbreak is actually has far more in common with withdrawal. Like it's in my mind, it has a lot more to do with what I imagine like a heroin addict would feel withdrawing from a drug that's so powerful. You know, when your soul is really bonded with somebody and you're really that close and then it's ripped away, you're not experiencing just like, to call it heartbreak is inaccurate. I think it has, chemically speaking in your brain, I think it has so much more to do with hard drug withdrawal. And I think each time I've had one of these relationships that has failed, it's allowed me to reassess what actually my goal is in terms of what I want, how to architect my life. Because when I was 18 and I was with my girlfriend Emma, I said, I want to drop out of university and buy a piece of land in upstate Connecticut and put a pod house on it and have a dog and like live this hippie lifestyle. And then when I broke up with Lauren at 24, 25, I was like, this is it. That's the end. I'll never love again. This is such a mess. I've got to flee the city. I need to move to Los Angeles.
Because your place together was New York and you needed to communicate.
Everything was toxic because everything reminded me of her. So I couldn't go, I couldn't go to Schiller's Liquor Bar and not think of her. I couldn't go to Finelli's Bar and have a Bloody Mary and like not think of her on a rainy day. So like,
yeah, been there.
Everything in that moment, my whole identity at that point in my life was New York. I was the biggest New York kid. My whole childhood, I grew up outside New York. All I wanted to do was ever live in New York. And after that relationship, all of a sudden I moved to LA and I started working for a car magazine.
But because of the relationship, did that play a big role in your decision to move?
Partially. It played a role. I just wasn't happy. It opened the door for me to be open to opportunities to get out. Mm-hmm. Because I was so like, I can't be around it. And we had our whole lives were together. And we're still, luckily, I'm still close with all these women and I count them all as friends and we keep in touch.
Because that's amazing.
When you share something that special with somebody, you can't just throw it out. You know, like there's always some part of you that goes, that was a special thing. And they know something about me that, as I was in that place and time, that is special to me still, almost to look back on. So, you know, I speak to them every few months or so. It's nice. But each time it ended, it gave me the chance to go, what the hell am I doing? Let's try something totally different. Mm. And then it's put
like
me...
master reset.
Master reset. And then it's put me down a path that has been so enriching and incredible that I don't know... I almost love every breakup for that reason, because it's given me a whole new chapter to open. I can't describe it better than that.
You're really lucky that you're friends with all of them. None of my exes will talk to me. So I wish I could have some of them back in my life. I was like, what? We clocked 4 years together. You don't even want to be in contact.
Yeah, I think it takes a certain level of emotional security of where I am to be like, you know what? I would actually love to hear from her today. Let's give her a call and see what she's up to. And tell me about her new boyfriend. I'll tell you about my new girlfriend, whatever. Like, life is too short for me to start making enemies. You know, it would crush me if I wasn't able to keep in touch with everyone in my life. And that's also one of the things that I think nobody really prepares you for when you're young. Is this feeling of losing touch with people. Like it's to me is the most painful feeling. I think about it all the time. Like all these people who I've loved and cared about and spent such powerful time with in my life, you know, to call them and have them not pick up feels like a personal failure on my behalf. But then if you look at like my parents' generation, people just lost touch with each other because that was how. There was no telephones. You had to like call somebody and leave a message. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was like the best you could do.
Yeah, no texting.
And now we have this surreal thing where I know exactly what they're up to because we all still follow each other on social media, whatever. But they become this sort of like walking dead ghost, you know, where you're like, I'm no longer in touch with them, but I know what they're up to. So it's, I don't know. We're in this surreal moment in history right now that is... It doesn't jive well with for me losing touch with people, but while having them also very visible. So I don't know. This is something I really work on maintaining my friendships and maintaining my relationships because they're really important to me.
Sleep was another recurring topic. Ariana wrote an entire book about it. Sophie from Sophie Tucker had trouble sleeping on tour. Licky Lee talked about just constant insomnia. It was really just a whole thing. You are Carmen Sandiego. You nonstop traveling, different city every week. What does your unwinding process and bedtime routine look like? Like, are you just loaded with adrenaline or do you pass out immediately?
I pass out surprisingly well, I have to say. But my secret is, and I'm not even sure this is good for other people, but I listen to a podcast every night before I go to bed. I truly listen.
Which one?
You know what's funny? I listened to the other night. I fell asleep so quickly. It was like Joe Rogan interviewing one of these UFO guys, and it was so out there and so out of whack. Like the more stupid and silly the podcast is, the more my brain cannot pay attention to it, and just, you know, I just fall asleep. So that was one that worked really well. But I like Radiolab. I always love falling asleep to Radiolab. There's one specific episode of Radiolab that always puts me to bed immediately. It's called Octomom, and it's about this octopus mother that was at the bottom of the ocean floor outside of San Francisco Bay. And it's the most emotional and beautiful podcast I've ever heard. God, that was a really good one. So yeah, I love storytelling, and I love having a story read to me as I fall asleep. My last real big relationship was with an English girl named Florence, and she had a beautiful accent. And I remember she would like sometimes read for me, read something to me. Like she'd find she was studying academia, and she would read an academic article, and I would be asleep in 30 seconds, you know, like this. So I like being read a story.
That's so funny, because how I fall asleep every night is there's this BBC podcaster named Melvin Bragg, and he just drones so on with other Oxford and Cambridge professors about philosophy.
It's so good, though. He'll be like, today we're talking about... the topics are always so random. He's like, today we're talking about the Moors and their interaction in 12th century, you know, like it's the most bizarrely specific thing. And he goes, well, to talk about this, we have Lawrence Bonanaba from the Cambridge School of exactly this one specific weird thing. This guy is the number one guy in the world for this one thing. It's called In Our Time.
Yes, In Our Time with Melvin Bragg. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's exactly a great one.
Do you have a bedtime poison? Like, do you take melatonin or NyQuil or valerian root? And I'm always asking everyone on this podcast because I have such bad sleep issues. So the rabbit needs tricks to add to her bag.
My rule with flying long distances is I never drink.
Why?
I think drinking is always like super, super dehydrating. You know, obviously, if maybe you're afraid of flying, maybe it helps you out to do what works for you. But for me, my secret for flying long distances was always never drink, pre-drink a ton of water. And then right before boarding, I would take a Xanax. And that was only ever used for flying. And I haven't taken a Xanax to go to sleep now in so long, because I find it to be a very powerful drug. And I don't. It's one of those things where you can feel yourself getting dependent on it very quickly. So I understand how it's such an epidemic to become addicted to even something as innocent as melatonin.
Yeah.
And I'm in a position now where I'm like, actually, I can sleep pretty much anywhere because I'm because I've done the other stuff in my life that gets me to a point where I'm actually quite still at night. But I there's definitely been points where I was like, wow, maybe I wish I could take an Ambien, but I don't like taking these drugs. I think people that take them end up in a position where they're in control by them, and I don't advocate that. Like I don't like feeling out of control, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I definitely hear you on that. I took Ambien once in my life and was so freaked out actually by the intensity of the sleep effect that was the one and only time I ever took it. So I also agree with you. The idea of a drug totally controlling your system and you having no agency, that definitely threw me for a loop.
Well, I mean, I was a DJ for a while. So like I understand the drug culture to a degree, but I have to say it's just not a culture that's worth investing in at my point in my career. I'm having too much fun doing other stuff.
A lot of our guests have hit some degree of rock bottom that led them to reevaluate how they're living their lives. Tucker from Sophie Tucker was on track to becoming a professional basketball player, but then his health derailed. He had to rethink his life, started making music from bed on his computer. And Young Pueblo started meditating after he stopped partying. And also he had a minor heart attack from the partying. So there's all these different rock bottoms. Yours doesn't necessarily have to be this dire health situation, but did you ever hit a low point that made you reevaluate things or change the course of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I've reevaluated, like I said, I've reevaluated my relationship with alcohol several times over my career. I've gone through periods of seeking treatment to try to find out what my relationship actually was. The biggest thing I took away from going to Alcoholics Anonymous and talking to a lot of people that had real struggles is that I actually learned that my struggles didn't quite match up with theirs. My struggles were really focused more around ego. And ego, ego-driven drinking, ego-driven feeling invincible, ego.
What do you mean by that, though, exactly? Like, what feeling would you feel on alcohol that was ego-driven?
No, what I'm trying to get back to is actually that ego is the thing that allows me to succeed, and ego is also the thing that tries to destroy me every day. So ego is pride, ego is confidence, ego is all the things that allow me to do my job really well are also the things that get me into a position where I'm no longer proud to be that person. So after talking to a few friends about it, after making a few social faux pas, I was like, oh, let me reevaluate this. Let me stop everything. Like, this isn't working in a way that feels sustainable for me. This isn't where I want to be right now in terms of my relationship with drinking, my relationship with my friends who invite me to these beautiful things that I get to go to, my relationship with my work. I said, let me just stop everything. And I took 6 months off.
When was this?
This was 2019, so before all the COVID started. And it was the most beautiful experience of my life because it was like going and talking to people who really work on their struggles is a very powerful thing for you to do because it's so humbling because you go, actually, that's a lot like what I feel, or like, actually, that's more than I feel, but I sympathize with it. So you go, one, immediately, I'm not alone. Like, I'm not alone in being concerned about how these things are affecting my life. And two, it's just like the analogy I said with therapy earlier, I took my hat off and I looked at the hat and I could talk about the hat with a professional and other people that are going through the same thing. And I'd really recommend, even if you think you're struggling a little bit with alcohol or drug use or anything, these rooms that you can go to and talk to people are so fascinating. And really helpful in terms of just giving yourself a dialogue about what's going on in your body. I'm still so grateful for the conversations I had in those rooms. And ultimately, it's given me the power to know that I can always go back to them if I feel that I'm getting to a place where I don't like to be. So treatment is always there. It's a huge journey. I don't know if in 10 years' time I'm still somebody who enjoys drinking, but at the moment I have a nice relationship with it. But I made this rule with myself that if something changes, if I'm waking up unhappy with who I was the night before when I had a few drinks with some friends or something like that, it's to me now I've opened up that pathway to get back to where I want to be. And I can go, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to stop this again. I don't like what's happening here. I'm going to go back to working on that. And there's no shame in rethinking it. And there's no shame in saying, actually, well, the strange thing is when you say to all your friends, I don't drink anymore, that is the weirdest and hardest thing at first, but then everyone kind of gets along with it.
I think there's also an association a bit with masculinity when men get together. That's the vibe that I have, you know, to like drink beer or like watch football. And I can imagine the social pressure as well. Even if you say no, there is still some residual social pressure that's there. And when Justin came on the show, we talked a ton about masculinity and how men have been conditioned to say yes to things they don't necessarily want to and to hide their emotions and feelings, because it's associated with weakness, and weakness is feminine, and feminine is bad, of course, right? And I'm curious where your idea of masculinity was formed and what your role model of masculinity was growing up.
I had one foot in both camps. You know, I was on one foot obsessed with James Bond, but then I was also raised by like a super powerful, strong mother who demanded I treat women in a certain way. So I can sympathize with people who got both. I understand people that come from a toxic masculine household, because I think had my mother not have been there, I would have grown up with, like, you know, James Bond is my role model, which I think is super unhealthy. But because she was there, she was always taking the piss out of him. And
like, in what way? Like, what lessons would she kind of impart to you?
No, just like, she would be like, oh God, you know, she would groan. If we were all watching a Bond movie together, she'd be like, oh my, no one actually behaves this way. Yeah. Like that, she's like, just don't do what he's doing.
Yeah.
And we always had a good sense of humor about it. You know, my father is not someone who's ever been overly, he's a very thoughtful, design-oriented human being. He builds houses and designs them from the soul. So I think to do what he does, you have to be someone who's really thoughtful about the human condition, because you have to think about how men and women interact in spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad's always been someone who, to me, was not, you know, like, he always loved like masculine stuff like car racing and James Bond. You know, I grew up listening to Sade, like, and Madonna. So, like, he bought me, like, my first Spice Girls album because he thought, oh, I didn't grow up in a household that was, like, AC/DC or nothing, you know? Like, it was very much like, no, we're students of the world. We're here to learn about from music and life and culture and food from everybody. And that's our gift, that we get to do that. That we get to receive that gift. And so that's the people that I come from.
And would your parents like meet the girls that you brought home, and were they excited for you to start your dating life, or were
they were like, what's taking you so long?
Why? Were you late bloomer?
I mean, I didn't have my first girlfriend till university. So I 18, and then we were at university. So it wasn't like I was bringing her home. So I think my parents were always excited for me to start dating, always excited for me to have my life. And, cause they're really people that are desperate to get as much value out of, you know, this, our laps around the sun as possible. They're like true lovers of life. And they wanted me to get to experience everything that they love about life as well. And it makes me tear up just thinking about it, because that's really what I believe that's their message and their gift to me is just, our time here is so limited. How can you afford to waste it not loving, not enjoying, not trying all these things? Like, you have to do it now, because if you don't do it now, when are you going to do it? Because that's the gift I received from them. And yes, I've had many ups and downs and struggles and hilarious things all along the way. But by and large, like, I'm receiving the gift. And I don't know, it feels good.
Last question we ask every guest. What drives you?
I touched upon it earlier. And what drives me is, like I said, very simple. I just don't want to move home. I love my home, and I love my parents, and I love all of these things that I come from, but I want to keep pushing. I want to see how far I can go. I want to see how much the sweater unravels. I'm desperate to go as far as possible. And that doesn't mean financially successful or anything like that. It means I want to get to the end of my life and know that I have seen and done and enjoyed and loved and tried as much as humanly possible. And if anything gets in the way of that, I go a different way.
That, my friends, was my conversation with Ted Gashue. And our last episode of the season. We are going to take a little break because we need to mind our mental health here over at the Driven Minds HQ, but we're going to be back within a couple of months with more conversations with amazing people and even something a little new. You can follow Ted at Ted Gashue and me at Gillian Sagansky. I always want to hear from you about whatever you want me to hear about, who you want to hear from on the podcast, what struggles you've been weathering that you'd want to unpack, or just to say, hey. Because I'm going to miss you. Until next time.